American Prairie is a local nonprofit working to connect and conserve more than 3 million acres of prairie grassland in Montana's northern Great Plains. American Prairie is one of the most ambitious conservation projects in existence today, representing an unprecedented opportunity to preserve temperate grasslands, which are one of the most threatened ecosystems in the world. To learn more about the incredible work American Prairie is doing for birds, habitat, wildlife, and local communities, visit www.americanprairie.org.
Hello and welcome to the American Birding Podcast from the American Birding Association. I am your host, Nate Swick. It is the last episode of the month, which means this month in birding. We'll get you there shortly. But first, a short update on guest host related concerns. As it happens, things in my personal orbit have turned out much more manageable than they seemed even as recently as a few weeks ago. This is great news. If for no other reason, then it means that my time away from the host chair will be less extensive than it could have been or that it appeared it would be. We're still going to use some guest hosts in the next month because some have graciously given their time and energy to this podcast, and I am grateful for that. But after all that, I should be able to return as I had before. Thanks to those who have sent their thoughts and well wishes, I do appreciate them. Let's get to the good stuff. This Month in Birding, featuring Frank Izaguirre, Ryan Mandelbaum, and Jordan Rutter talking waving tits, seabird spies, and dream birds, among other things. All after this week's Rare Birds. This is your Rare Bird Focus for the end of April 2024. We have, in 2024's fourth month, its first absolute banger of a rare bird. From Cannon Beach, Oregon, in Clatsop County, comes a photo of what appears to be Oregon and the ABA area's first confirmed record of blue rock thrush and a stunning adult male, no less. This very distinctive and attractive thrush is found across southern Europe and Asia. The easternmost subspecies, Philippensis, of which this individual looks to represent, is visually distinctive with a chestnut belly, and it breeds in eastern Mongolia and Japan and winters in the Philippines and Indonesia. Though this is a potential ABA first, it is, however, not the first occurrence of blue rock thrush in the ABA area. There was a record from June 1997 in interior British Columbia that was not accepted by the ABA checklist committee at the time because of questions about provenance. That decision has been questioned many times over the years, and this current record may prompt a reevaluation of that bird, which was photographed, and also of the Philippensis subspecies. Like the previous BC record, the location and date of this bird suggests a northbound migrant rather than a spring vagrant directly from Asia, which means that maybe this bird reached North America the previous fall, which, as you might remember, was a good one for Asian vagrants in the Pacific Northwest. There were multiple Emberiza buntings and several brambling, and wintered, unseen, somewhere in the West. If not for the rock thrush in Oregon, an oriental turtle dove in Vancouver, British Columbia would take top billing this week. This is BC's fourth record of this striking migratory pigeon. Most records of this species in the ABA area, predictably, come from Alaska. But in addition to the three previous BC records, it has been documented as far south as Northern California. One additional first record this week, and yet another Asian vagrant, though one that nests in small numbers in the ABA area in western Alaska. Ohio's first white wagtail was seen this week in Montgomery County. It looks to be of the East Asian Ocularis subspecies, which is the one that breeds in Alaska, for what it's worth. White wagtail is one of Eurasia's most common breeding birds, with around 10 recognized subspecies, and thus one of North America's most common Eurasian vagrants, though those records are concentrated on both ends of the continent, as you might expect. Ohio is only the sixth inland state with a record, though that does stretch the definition of inland a bit. Both Manitoba and Texas records are well inland, but those places do border saltwater, so you should perhaps take that with this little bit of trivia. That's all we have this week. For the full list, check out the ABA Rare Bird Alert on Fridays at aba.org/RBA. You can also follow along with all the rare bird news in our ABA Rare Bird Alert group on Facebook and in ABA community. April is here. Spring migration is happening. And the This Month in Birding panel for April 2024 is as timeless and bold as the new eBird font. I hope you all survived the great eBird graphic design change unscathed and are here ready to discuss birds, birding, and bird science. I'll introduce you first, and then I'll ask you the eBird font question before we get going. What a crew. Let's introduce them. He is an editor for the ABA's Birding Magazine and a newly official PhD. Congratulations to you for that. It's Frank Izagirre. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Nate. Thanks.
They're a science writer, creator of Bird Moto, and a Finch aficionado, I suppose, which might be a joke I've used before. I honestly cannot remember. Hello again to Ryan Mandelbaum.
It's as great always,
to see
great
you
to be here,
and our friend from Bird Names for Birds and the American Bird Conservancy, here to add to her current record for most appearances on the American Birding Podcast non-host edition. It's Jordan Rutter. Welcome back, Jordan.
Hi, all. Happy spring migration.
Have you been watching the freak out about the new eBird fonts? It's not really what I planned on talking about, but I'm indifferent to it all. I don't know what you all think.
I'm totally indifferent. I mean,
fine.
So like, I get it. I mean, the original font was iconic, like looking at that serif the E. Beautiful. But at the same time, I can't get that. I'm too busy birding.
I love that answer. Let's just end it there. Too busy birding. You're too busy using the app.
It's like a Sanderling. It's the Sanderling of eBird logos, since it is without a serif. As Sanderling is without behind a helix. They should just call it that. They should just explain it like that. I'm sure everyone would understand. Anyway, let's start with a story that caught my eye, if for no other reason that I feel like we birders have had to deal with the fallout from one Peter McIndoe for many years now. If you may not be familiar with the name, but you're certainly familiar with his creation. McIndoe is the great mind. And I use that term in italics, in quotes, and said with a sneer behind birds aren't real. The movement that, as McIndoe tells it, was intended to be an absurdist satirical take on the surveillance state, but turned into the thorn in the side of every birder, because how many people, when you would let them know that you were into birds, would then turn to you and say, you know, those aren't real. Har, hardy, har, har. McIndoe came clean in 2021 about the nature of his movement, and now he is hoping to turn this notoriety into a political career. Good for him, I guess. But my question to you is, when will Peter McIndoe be held responsible for his crimes against ornithology? And will it be soon?
I lost a lot of respect for him for giving up the gig, you know? Like, why did he lose his stamina?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
You know, he couldn't handle it anymore or what?
Yeah. He knew the truth.
Go ahead.
Oh, I want to know how much money he made, because I know a fair bit. Like,
yeah.
I know bird people that bought all of the Birds Aren't Real like swag as a joke. Like, it came full circle and was like a funny thing. So I'm just like, how do we get in on that? Like,
I know. It's like I am here trying to make a living, and the birds are real. Area, and it is not as lucrative, I'll just tell you that.
No, it's not.
So I don't know how much you all talk to just random people, but I, obviously living in New York City, have my fair share of interactions with cab drivers, bartenders, guys on the street, and I will say that as harmless as you think a pretend conspiracy theory will be, it is not. I have had several conversations with people who were all in that birds were not real. They had added it to their huge list of crazy globalist conspiracy, you know, Illuminati things. And I just had to sit there with the bartender once, and he was getting really heated. And I was just like, hey, man, maybe some birds are
fine. To avoid confrontation. just to end this conversation. Yeah.
So I hate the birds aren't real conspiracy for that one reason, that some conspiracy theorists really go all in, and I don't, you know, I get it. So the world is bad. I see a reason for some conspiracies, but that one really
it hurts.
Well, you can avoid such problems by just really trying not to talk to anybody. That's one solution that has helped me with the birds aren't real.
You're not birding enough, Ryan. I thought you said you were birding all the time. You don't got time to talk to people if you're out birding.
Yeah.
you know, they find you in this city of 8 million people, 21 million, challenging. Whatever the numbers are, they find you.
I am shocked by how much this project, conspiracy theory, art project, I have no idea. I was shocked by how much it kind of wormed its way into the consciousness of literally everyone. I just would like an apology from Peter. That's fine. Like, if he wants to apologize to birders in general, bird scientists, everyone involved in birds.
Get him on the show.
Yeah, maybe I should. Maybe I should hold his feet to the fire. Be like, Peter, can we please get an apology? Interview over. Maybe shortest episode ever. Because I don't care about any of the other stuff.
Your listeners, everybody here who's listening today would be absolutely, I'm sure you'd all be so happy. I mean, I own a Birds Aren't Real t-shirt. I think it's actually very funny. I just have a lot of heartburn from this whole thing.
Well, he sounds like he's got his career in politics cut out for him, if that's the case.
So this is great. So you probably all know other people and you probably communicate with them in some ways, perhaps with gestures. You might give them a thumbs up or motion them with your hands. Now, we know that birds obviously use their body parts to do things. You know, they might have ornamentation to display to a mate, something like that. But there hasn't been a lot of research done, some, but not a lot, on whether they're actually using their body parts to communicate things. So in this study, scientists based in Japan, they had nest boxes. I think they studied 8 pairs of Japanese tits. And in 321 nest visitations, they noticed that these Japanese tits would begin fluttering their wings when their mates arrived. So they would arrive usually at the nest, let's say at the same time, and then one of them would then go fly off to the side, and then they would start fluttering their wings at the other one, and then they would go into the nest box. And they observed this a lot. It seems that it was mainly the females who were doing this wing fluttering, 6 of the 8 that they studied, accounting for 15% of all the nest visitations. And 42% of all the visitations accompanied by the mate. Only one male did the wing flutter. But what was cool to me was at first I was like, I don't know, maybe they were just fluttering at each other. But it seemed like, A, the arrival of the order didn't change things. If one of them fluttered at the other one would go into the nest. That's the first thing. And the second, it seemed that the males would enter the nest faster if they were being fluttered at than if not. So it really does seem to be saying that these birds are communicating in some way after you. And so these were, you know, these were all nest boxes where they were usually the tits were arriving to feed the young. So I just think it's like a great little thing because all of us feel like we're watching birds and kind of we all know that something's going on, right? Like they all got little bird things that they're doing. But how much of that is just me making it up, you know, like, oh, yeah, they're tweeting at me. They're scratching their heads. You know, what are they communicating? But in this case, it really does seem like there may be some sort of more symbolic communication that that birds are doing aside from just like tweeting and fighting and, you know, copulating and all the other bird stuff. But they might actually be having little conversations with each other, a little bit of bird gestures. So that's all I got. But a delightful little story. And I just like this paper has all these like cute little pictures of Japanese tits fluttering their wings at each other. I think the phrase after you is in the title of the paper. Thank you for doing this study. That just made me so happy.
I think we all know that there are people from, you know, certain backgrounds that tend to use their hands more when they talk. I wonder if there are birds from different places that tend to use their wings more when they talk. Hey,
I'm walking here. You can't see it because we are listening to this podcast, not watching it, but we all just
shaking
put our
hands
up.
Gesture.
You know, you can see what we're doing.
Well, it makes me think of the like drawn hands on like the birds that seen those memes in the videos. Yeah. Like it makes me think like, what are bird gifs? Or like if birds had emojis, what would they be using? just with Ryan's like thumbs up and everything. It's pretty silly.
Oh, like if the birds themselves were making the gifts,
exactly.
what would they
inscrutable like? To humans. But I'm sure they would carry a lot of interesting things.
Yeah. Well, there's this guy I work with at the Finch Research Network. Well, I haven't worked with him one-on-one yet, but I edit a lot of his posts. And Connor Rosenblatt, and he's a real human, and you know, Holly Merker also. They're really big proponents of slow observation and not just looking at birds, but really like just being there with them. And I think that Connor wrote a really nice piece for our upcoming Finch Research Network newsletter where he kind of talks about experiencing his lesser goldfinches and watching them closely. And it really kind of felt like they were almost being playful, which a lot of people would say, oh, like playful. No way. They're just little like automata. But I think that my takeaway from this study is kind of the same thing. It's just like a great just go watch the birds more closely. Take that like extra 20 seconds to really kind of immerse yourself in bird life. And, you know, maybe the birds really are like communicating little messages that you'll be able to figure out. You know, I mean, that's my favorite part, is watching the birds be real to each other and not just kind of like look at me and then fly away.
Holly has written for the magazine, including recently, and it's kind of interesting that you mention that, because on the one hand, when I see a story like this, it's one of those discoveries that's kind of amazing to me as a non-scientist, because in order to like write a paper about such an observation, it seems like so challenging and incredible that people can take these, I think these birds are like communicating by flapping in certain ways, and to run that idea through the rigors of science and be able to publish it as a paper and as reviewed research is just amazing that people can do that. But then there's the other side of it where it's like, you know, birding and close observation and slow birding and all those kinds of ideas are like good for your mental health and they're good for becoming a better birder. Like that's the kind of stuff that Holly is very interested in. So it's kind of, it's interesting how the same thing can be viewed through those different sides of birding and mm-hmm. still be amazing in different ways.
Almost feels like they're like two opposite ends of the spectrum, but it's a horseshoe theory, but for birding.
Yeah. And I mean, I have a background in science writing, and it's like always my first instinct to read a paper and kind of like roll my eyes and be like, oh, how do they know that? Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they were just mm-hmm. fluttering because they just do that. And I know I read through this paper and I was just like, oh, this is really interesting work. You know, they made all the observations. It was pretty rigorous. And, you know, it really did kind of amaze me that they were able to kind of tease out some of the, you know, some of the intricacies of all the different things that these birds could be doing and, you know, measure some data that kind of demonstrates like, no, these birds, it seems like, you know, these gestures seem to be communicating something to one another. And it seems to be really consistent across, you know, each of these different birds. And now actually scientifically, what would be really interesting is like, yeah, what other bird species do this? Do Japanese tit species do
is
this
it a learned
elsewhere?
Behavior?
Do they between, do the same yeah. gesture? Mm-hmm. Is it learned? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this cultural? I mean, there's a lot of those studies in the cockatoos who mm-hmm. open up the garbage bins in Australia. Are they learning it from each other? Are there tits that don't do this? You know, there's a whole bunch avenue of things that I'm really interested in now.
It's
that
it's a career path. You know, someone who's early in their PhD or maybe getting a master's might be thinking about these things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it surprises anyone that of the birds that are first birds that are recorded to use sort of manual gestures, or I guess it's not manual because manual implies hands, but I don't know what the equal term for wings would be, but manual gestures, I'll use that, are parrots. Like, because they totally are social. Mm. There's a hierarchy. Yeah. They are clearly paying attention to each other. Like, it does not surprise me at all that these are the birds that we have, you know, recorded doing this sort of thing.
I feel like a lot of the studies, maybe it's just because parrots tend to be mm-hmm. kind of easy to study because they take to nest boxes and things. But so many of these studies, you're always just like, darn, chickadees yeah. are like so much yeah. smarter than I mm-hmm. thought they were.
And I think it's interesting that it's a gesture that we recognize. Maybe it suggests that, you know, there could be human avian sign language and communication at some point.
I was trying to find, I just saw a picture of a bird that actually has like little extra wing feather segments on their wings that make it look like they have hands. Thank you. I was like, I need to contribute that to this conversation.
It's a good one. Yeah, I can see them doing it too.
But yeah, just because again, the little drawn on arms. But I also to Frank, like, that was such a like philosophical contribution to this topic. And I just wanted to call that out too, because it's birds are amazing and there's so many questions, and it's amazing to me that we can learn so much simply through observation, right? Like when you think about these super complex models or experiments or things like that, but someone just watched some tits for a while and then like figured this out. That's amazing. If that's what you can figure out, then definitely science just continues to advance and we're just going to learn more about birds, which mind-boggling. Just mind-boggling.
I think Holly will be delighted to hear if the challenge we issue to the listeners today is to observe your birds more closely and see if you too can notice them communicating with one another like mm-hmm, this. And I'm only sort of joking. Like, I want to go out and see if the chickadees in the park are doing this to each other.
Yes, we are switching gears tremendously. We are going from land to sea. We are going to from little birds to big birds. We're going to a group of birds that are so special, someone changed their name to them. Debbie loves Shearwater. So we're talking about Shearwater, specifically in the Mediterranean Sea. They're spies. So actually, birds aren't real. As we just determined, they are spies.
Maybe this is the example that proves that Mikindo is correct.
Yeah, I can't help it. It's right there. A new paper published in the Society for Conservation Biology came out that is really sharing about how shearwaters, specifically this group of birds that are incredible flyers, they're in a habitat that seems very far away for many of us, very remote, are actually helping us understand both the threats to this bird, but also what people are up to on boats. So cue the Lonely Island song, get your flippy floppies. We're going on an adventure through this manuscript because boats seem very far away. How are they a threat to these seabirds? But they are, whether you're talking about oil spills, whether you're talking about bycatch and other fishing net threats. As birders, we tend to think about pelagics and especially that chumming aspect where you put all the dead fish and everything out the back of the boat to track these seabirds. There's still an interaction that, again, is a threat to these birds. But it's something that we don't really know about to the best extent that we could. Focusing on the boat aspect, there's a lot of tracking, a lot of radar, a lot of ways that boats, both for people and for the boat itself, navigate and make sure that we know where they are and have safety and navigation and everything. Many boats, especially medium to large vessels, have automatic identification systems. It's similar to a pit tag of sorts. Again, it just tracks where it goes. But we're talking about people here. We're talking about potential illegal activities. So the pit tag concept is only useful if people actually use it and have it turned on. This is where the shearwater spy conspiracy theory comes into play. So the scientists of this paper actually put additional devices on shearwaters in order to pick up where they flew and what radar from those boats they interacted with. So whether the vessels were consciously or intentionally using their tracking devices, the shearwaters would still note with these additional little like backpacks they were carrying, how they interacted and what the GPS location of those vessels were, which is amazing, right? So boats can't go dark. They can't become invisible to shearwaters, at least. So basically, again, shearwaters were detecting all of the vessel traffic in the Mediterranean Sea where they were flying and mapping out all of these boats. And so ultimately, that's going to help us fill all of these knowledge gaps. We're going to learn more because of this information for how shearwaters interact with fishing vessels, how close they were to the vessel itself. Again, thinking through those threats, we'll be able to understand more about the bird behavior. And then we'll also be able to learn more about where hotspots for illegal fishing activities or where vessels are going that could pose bigger problems for these birds. So ultimately, birds are amazing. And yes, you got to. But also just thinking through that really mutualistic, beneficial relationship of we have questions about these birds. There's also a lot of conservation needs for these birds. So how can the birds help inform people to do better and us do better for the birds? Which is just, again, a really incredible scientific concept, if nothing else.
Yeah, I was struck by this in this story. Which essentially, you know, documents ways in which shearwaters can find illegal fisheries. Because it reminds me a lot of the persecution of vultures in a lot of places, because, you know, and some, one of the bigger issues with vultures these days is that poachers recognize that vultures can be used to give away their location when they are illegally hunting large African mammals. And so they actually target the vultures. And that has been one of the, you know, one of the, I don't know if it's underappreciated elements of vulture population decline in sub-Saharan Africa in particular. I wonder if people doing the illegal fishing will recognize that these shearwaters are giving away their location.
The rhyme of the Ancient Mariner is a cautionary tale.
It's real.
Don't even think about it.
Yeah.
I know the podcast has reach. I don't know if there's any going to be any fishermen who go to illegal fishing.
I hope not.
Hear it. But if you are listening, don't even think about it.
But I think it's interesting, both as one, a way to find where this illegal fishing is taking place and to kind of focus law enforcement. But two, the worry that the illegal people doing the illegal fishing might somehow harm these pelagic birds when they realize that that is how they're getting, you know, fingered, as it were, for this illegal acts. So, you know, in some ways, maybe it's more difficult since it's hard to pin down some of these birds and, you know, how many can you shoot? But I don't know. It's fascinating and also worrying, I suppose.
I completely agree. And I think, you know, the study area of this paper was, again, on the Mediterranean Sea, more most specifically. But when you think about wisdom, the albatross and all of the other seabirds, and they're these incredible athletes of sorts, like mapping the ocean is such a feat, right? Like just thinking about how far these birds can fly and like what information is untapped that they could help us with trying to be more positive for conservation than illegal fishing.
Sure. Yeah.
Because again, I'm here for the birds. but it's just incredible to think about, again, all of those questions that we have at large, and then how do we actually go about answering them, and that the birds can help you.
It's going to be a bit of a challenge for me to try and convince my bartender friends that birds are not
when that, they're being used by...
not only are they real, they're cops.
That's right.
Yeah. But I mean, I agree. I mean, and also I think a lot of, if you haven't been on a pelagic trip, it's actually funny because this one resonated with me because I remember going on one out of New York, and it was kind of a slow day. And then at the end of the day, we found a fishing boat, and we were like, all right, here we go. We like went right up to it. There was just dozens of Cory shearwaters behind it. We picked a Scopoli shearwater, you know, out from the flock, and it was really, really cool. So just this like shearwaters, they find the
good
fishing boats. And so it totally makes sense. That's the thing they do best. I actually asked a Cory shearwater what they thought about this. And it was interesting because it was this.
Did he make wing gestures? Because otherwise I'm not going to be able to translate that. I'm going to need the gestures.
Yeah, he was just sitting there. Ow,
got
ow,
it.
Ow,
got it. Yeah, 10-4. Ow.
I think I'm out at 100% making bird noises on the for my
it's a bit podcast. I appreciate it. It's a good one.
The shearwaters in this store, they are Cory's. They were some of the different Calanectra species.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Cory, yes. Scopolis, or and Scopolis, Cape whatever, and Cape Verde, which is, they're all formally considered one species and now two, and in some cases three, depending on which taxonomic authority you prefer.
Yeah, let's not get into names and taxonomy.
My story. The title of the article is Tropical Field Stations Yield High Conservation Return on Investment. And so it's an interesting article. It's basically it was kind of like a meta survey more than anything about, maybe that's the right term to describe it. It was about how throughout the survey, the study covered field stations in the tropics, throughout the tropics. So Latin America, Africa, and also Asia. And there were 157 different field stations contacted and surveyed in 56 different countries. And it was not strictly these field stations, it said in the paper that they're more centered around primate research. So these are kind of the kind of places that are known primarily for doing primate research, but with implications for all kinds of different branches of scientific study. And basically, the result was that the researchers felt that these places are very cost-effective. Funding these places is a very cost-effective way to benefit conservation efforts, because many of these field stations run on very low operating budgets and they yield really good conservation results in a few different measurable ways. Habitat preservation, overall biodiversity, diminishment of hunting, different things like that. So it's the kind of paper that is kind of interesting, because it's interesting to read, but there's like a certain tension there, because you can tell that the authors of the paper, many, many authors, like dozens of authors, they're trying to put conservation outcomes into like quantitative economic terms, which is a good thing to do, but it's like a little strained and it's a little sad, because they're like trying to justify something that we know is good and that they know is good, but they're like trying to put it in financial terms. I think it's very nice that the paper exists. I hope that it's able to help these places, which birders sometimes enjoy. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit. And birders can support those kinds of places.
Yeah.
That they often run on like very modest shoestring budgets. Even the ones that are like a little more well funded are can be pretty bare bones. So that's really nice to know that they do have a high impact. And I hope the paper can help those places.
That was sort of the angle that I appreciated the most from it. It is an opportunity to talk a little bit about, have you ever birded on a tropical field station?
That's what I was thinking to do too. So,
and it was fantastic, not only because the birding was very, very good, but it's really neat to be there and know that you are sort of among all these researchers doing stuff, you know, studying all manner of tropical taxa. I remember the first time I went to the one, the famous La Selva. Yeah.
La Selva's in Costa Rica.
And, you know, you're eating breakfast there, ready to go birding, and there are researchers there coming up that are doing work on army ants, and researchers that are doing work on tropical shrubby plants, and there are researchers doing all sorts of cool stuff. And it's just neat to be in the midst of all these people doing fascinating work in a really fascinating place, even if all you want to do is see like a snowy Katinga or something.
Oh, I mean, La Selva is so fun. Yeah. And I felt the same thing. I mean, just you really feel like you're part of something. Like, it's not just like, you know, you can go birding all over Costa Rica and obviously it's amazing, but La Selva, you like go through these gates and you're just in like, it's kind of like Bird Disney World. If Disney World was like a science, reserve, maybe a little bit of like biosphere kind of situation or biodome, whatever you call it. But it's, you know, birds are so good. I saw a slated bird there. I can't complain.
Just imagining like a like someone in a sunbittern costume like coming around the corner and being like,
Pauly Shore in a, if we're doing the biodome connection. No one knows who Pauly Shore is anymore. It's probably for the best.
Oh, we
not to get too like deep or philosophical, but I feel like there's so much potential here for how to positively impact conservation and birding as well, especially with all of the more those foundational issues that we're dealing with as a community. I mean, knowing that college students go to field stations, knowing that there's professional development opportunities at field stations, like investing in them could be maybe not so much focused on the economic aspect, as Frank was saying, but just as places to bring people together, to give them more training opportunities, to get them in the field. I know lots of, several college students who had field station experiences that totally changed their lives, not to over-exaggerate, but that experience is really important, especially when we think about the future of birding and conservation and science. Like that, I think on the one hand, a high return on investment could be more than economic. I think it's worthy to talk about the money aspect just because conservation is so expensive, but return on investment in terms of more bird-focused folks, more even primate-focused folks is mm-hmm. not a bad thing in the world today.
Yeah. Well, and I'll also add that like the economic incentives, a lot of them in the tropics is just to like
right.
clear the forest so that you can grow food. And like, I can't say anything to that, right? Because I don't live there, but you know, something like this actually provides another route that can support mm-hmm. people who live in the area as well. I mean, not only are they employing people to maintain the reserve, but if you look at some of the papers that come out of the reserve, I mean, many of them are published by universities mm-hmm. that are based in the local area. So, you know, of course, Americans want to like go down to La Selva and go bird watching through college and say it's their, you know, ornithology degree. But like, it is exciting that these places exist so that these countries can kind of maintain their own cultural and scientific stories and take care and like, you know, be proud of it, you know, and like, it is fun to look at these papers and see like, oh yeah, you know, this came out, this is great work from universities in Costa Rica or in Ecuador. And then there's also beyond that, I know that like I visited Tapichalaca in Ecuador, which is where the Hokotoko ant pit is. And, you know, they'll often work with the local communities to kind of build support for these and say like, listen, the existence of this reserve above your town is actually really exciting because it means that it's either, if you clear this land and put agriculture there, it might ruin all your water. But, you know, if said there's like beautiful, pristine cloud forest here and your water's going to be
Cleaner. I mean, the ABC Reserve Network mm-hmm. is a huge way that we're working towards all of that. The ant pit is, there's several reserves for ant pittas actually, which is pretty silly when you think about it. Hokotoko, Cundinamarca. But that whole model is, again, a way to really empower that area. The people on the ground are leading the way and doing this incredible work that needs that acknowledgement and support. And then having that partnership helps fuel it, which is great because it also shouldn't be just Americans that are putting things on others. Of course, we want to, you know, do it in collaboration for sure.
So just to put on your ABC hat for a second, Jordan,
yes.
A lot of these are managed as tropical research stations. Specifically?
More so eco lodges than research.
It's a fine line in a lot of cases.
It is. So, but there's a network of 100 across Central and South America. So definitely, on the one hand, there's the phrase of it's a small world. But when you think about the birds, it proves how big it is, which is amazing.
I think the field stations for people that are intrigued by the concept of them are a nice thing to think of for people who are itching to travel and are thinking about it and are considering them. I haven't been to a lot of them personally, but here's the deal with them, in my opinion, what I suspect. One, it's nice to support those places if you can. A lot of them, you know, they're not taking visitors, mm-hmm. but some of them do, and that can be lucrative for them. So that's nice to consider. And they're not going to be, it's like this, they're much more affordable in general than eco lodges. So for people who want to keep the budget down or need to keep the budget down, they can be a nice option. Now, keep in mind, they're going to be relatively expensive for how nice the accommodations are. It's like a little,
you're saying they're rustic.
They're like a little rustic is like the nice euphemistic word that people use there. They're comfortable in their way. You know, you don't want the bed to be too comfortable because you want to get up at five in the morning, right? So they're helping you out. But just so that's like, it's nice. I think it's nice for birders to consider those places, you know, in light of the findings of this study. That's kind of my impression of them. I've stayed at three that I can think of. Yeah. So, anyway.
Well, I mean, sure, I can sleep in an uncomfortable bed, but then I get to like wake up squawks of great green macaw, and then there's like snowy Katinga literally over.
You don't have to get
lot.
In a car and
like,
go somewhere.
If you haven't been to La Selva,
that's nice.
The if you want to see snowy Katinga, when you go to La Selva, you just stand in the parking lot, and then eventually one just shows up, and it's basically every day.
That's how I saw mine.
It's amazing.
Well, and not to you know, be too ABC marketing oriented, but a lot, of the
we'll hit them up for sponsorship here after this.
Oh yeah. Well, I can make those
we'll
connections.
We'll talk afterwards.
Yep. But some of the ABC reserves are for the most endemic, smallest habitat available for these birds too. So, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. you're talking about some species being right there, but also cherry-throated tanager, for example, like there's only a few of them in the entire world. So having that both like safe space for the birds, but safe space to go observe the birds is just another really nice benefit for sure.
And don't worry, the accommodations can be perfectly rustic at a eco lodge. You know, you don't just have to get rustic accommodations at a biological station. I've stayed at my share of tarantula in the shower type places. That's why it's good.
Baked in. That's
I naturalist the tarantula. It's so exciting. Yeah. I was so excited.
Cherry-throated tanager is one of the ones that has skunked Peter Kastner.
Oh, really?
He's like tried for it multiple times, including last year, and he didn't get it. It's a hard one.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to the question of the month. The question of the month. The New York Times published a fascinating piece this month entitled Do Birds Dream? The Times continuing to publish lots of great bird content in the last year and a half or so. The essay discussed research into REM sleep and dreaming as we know it. In birds, it raised questions about the adaptive nature of dreams and their evolution, both in humans and non-human animals. It's neat stuff. Link in the show notes. I'm going to take it a completely different direction. Sure, maybe birds dream. I don't know. But we know that humans do. I want to know if you have ever dreamed about birds or birding, and if so, what birds did you see, and did you put them on your dream life list?
Okay. Get ready. So ready. Coincidentally, 10 years ago, today, we're talking April 18th, 2014, I had never dreamed about a bird before that I knew of, right? Because sometimes you don't know if you dream.
I don't know whether I'm more impressed with the story or the fact that you have kept such good records of your own dreams, Jordan. April 18th, 10 years ago. I don't even know what I was doing April 18th, 10 years ago.
Okay.
So anyway, moving on. Sorry, I interrupted.
No. Listeners, you all know I'm a dork.
Yeah,
so, like, enough. What? Yeah. Okay. So, April 18th, 2014, I never knew I dreamed about birds before in my life. I meet Tom Will. And Tom Will tells me randomly at some like get together function bird thing that he dreamt about birds last night. And I was like, dreamt about birds last night? And he was like, yeah, I had dreamed about this like bird that was made up in his dream, and it was number something something on his dream list. My mind was blown. That night, I dream my first ever known bird, a Carolina wren, and started my dream list. Okay. So I have a spreadsheet that has now documented. Okay. Oh yeah, I'm a birder. Okay. Don't give me that.
Fair enough. Like, no, I when I came up with this question, I did not expect that it would go in this direction, and I'm thrilled. Jordan, please continue.
That's why you have me on the podcast.
That's exactly right.
And so now, after 10 years, I have had some repeat species on my dream list. I'm up to 76 identifiable bird species. I've had some weird ones, like made up ones too. Some standout dreams.
Yeah, please.
Because I'm here for it. In the spirit of birds are amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've said it several times on the podcast, so I'm hoping you're all with me in that regard. Okay. I have dreamed about another friend of the podcast, Janet Ng.
Okay.
And we have swan dived off Bird Rock in Cape St. Mary's, Newfoundland to catch puffins.
I've been there. That would be very dangerous.
Yep. I also had a dream one time of a turkey vulture in the apartment during COVID lockdown, and I thought it was so real.
What does that mean?
I don't know, but I thought it was so real. I woke up and like shook Gabriel freaking out, checking the apartment.
There's like a death anxiety angle to that, I think.
Maybe.
Who knows? Got to unpack this.
I one time took a group of bikers out on a
like motorcycles or
yeah.
Okay.
So I think I was like trying to get in touch with like my badass side or something. I
hear
don't know.
You. Yeah.
And then my final kicker is one time I went to Hawk Mountain with Ken Kaufman, uh-huh, where we rode unicorns and watched the hawk migration happen. And that is all documented in my spreadsheet. So Dreambirds. It's where it's at. That's what I've got.
Spectacular. I did not expect any of that. Way better than mine. I'm sorry for anyone that has to follow that. Go ahead.
Well, then I'm going to follow it up.
Yeah.
Because guess what? Oh, I too keep a dream.
Yes. Nerds unite. Yeah.
So the bird that has appeared the most times in my dreams is the upland sandpiper.
Ooh, wow.
I also include a lot of information. Yep. Often the comments will just be like, flyby, came to apartment feeder. But a couple of really great ones that I've got here. Let me find it. Evening grosbeak, enormous, eating in an agricultural field, big enough to see from a fast-moving train. American avocet, one of several spotted in the Northeast, and was feeding in my parents' backyard. A bunch of Brooklyn birders came to see it, and then it came up to a woman on the sidewalk and started preening her dog. Then she put the bird on a leash and walked it home.
I could see that.
Sure. Yeah. That's the kind of pet you want. Yep. Yeah.
American bittern. Pair in my hometown park ended up being my friends, and we had a photo shoot on a carousel. It's not that they were people dressed as bitterns. They were bitterns that sometimes had human faces. We reasoned that the photo shoot was ethical because they really wanted to ride the carousel, and I just happened to be there. So I even went into photo ethics in some of these dreams. And then I'll just add that it is often very... One thing that you may notice if you keep a dream list is that photographing birds in your dreams is very hard. Often your tech doesn't work that great in dreams. But I often am very, when it does happen, it's like I put a star next to it, successfully photographed bird, everything went well. And I've written about my birds in my dreams so much that I now have started to be able to photograph them without like the wiggly camera settings not working.
Gosh.
But yes, if you start keeping track of your birds in your dreams, especially if you're a photographer, and you'll notice that cameras, they just don't work that well in dreams. There's always something weird going on, but
wow.
You'll figure it out.
Wow. This is amazing. This is amazing. Yeah.
Kismet.
Do you two, you've seen so many birds, you have such robust dream bird lists. Do you have like a target bird or like goal birds for your that you don't have on your dream bird list yet that you want to try to get someday? Either you or you, Nate.
I don't even have a dream list.
Yeah.
I mean, and more as I love Katingas, and I feel like Katingas are weird enough in real life that I want to see what kind of weird Katingas my dreams can concoct. I mean, there are plenty of made-up birds too. there's like 12-striped castle bird is the most interesting-looking bird I've had in my dreams. It looked like a little white castle
bird. It is weird when you identify the like fantasy birds in your dreams.
Like with confidence? Like,
yes,
oh yeah, that's a 12-striped castle bird.
Yeah, exactly. Because I've had some where I'm like, I wake up and I'm just like, wow, that was like sci-fi or something. But I still like try to describe the bird on my list, but I don't name it, right? It's not a real identifiable bird. And then there are some birds where like I name it and I'm just like, where was I? Like, what alternative universe did I like get transported to in my dream? So...
Yeah, a lot of the time too, I'll find that there are birds who it'll be a real bird name, but the way that I dream it is like totally different than the way I know it looks. Like in here, I have birds that are crimson collared grosbeak. This was the name of the bird that I inherently knew the birder was talking about, but it was actually a chestnut collared longspur. And also in the dream, it was a European bird that I had somehow seen on Long Island, We were banding it, and it was small and fluffy and round and looked more like a blue Eurasian tree sparrow. That is the comment for Crimson Collared Gross. Yeah. Dreams, they're That's weird. What do you want me to tell you?
Maybe we should Sorry, be Frank. Studied. Maybe no, no. like the theme of this episode is like
maybe,
all about
maybe
like,
you
the
should
scientific
start a
research.
Podcast. The like, both of you.
Oh yeah.
Dream birds.
Or like, oh, or and then this is where you can also be like bird behavior and stuff. Like I have one documented where I just got pooped on by birds. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Like it was just like a shower effect. Yeah. So the details are strange.
Incredible.
Here's one. And one morning I woke up and checked my camera when I woke up to see if I had gotten photos of the bird that I had seen in my dream.
Had you?
So I mean, oh, okay. No. Buff-breasted sandpiper. I guess I had gotten photos in the dream. And then at 5:30, I was in a daze like, whoa, and my camera just popped out of my bed. So I like picked it up and turned it on.
How about
wait.
You, Frank? Do you remember any dreams? Like I cannot compete with any of this.
No, I mean, basically, no. I mean, I have remembered dreams a few times in the past, but I mean, I'm sure I've dreamed of, I know there have been times in my life when I was like really birding, like a lot, which is not so much the case right now, but there have been times when I was birding so much the way you want it to be, mm-hmm. that I would close my eyes before going to sleep and I would hear yellow warblers or blackpoll warblers. And I always felt like that's when you're in it. And you really got to appreciate those times. And so I'm sure when I was in those moments that I would probably dream about birds more. Maybe I do now and I just don't remember. Yeah. I know there have been times too when sometimes here in Pittsburgh, there are very large crow movements, especially in the fall. It's really what happens in the fall. And you hear them going over our house at like 4 a.m. and sometimes they can wake you up. And I know there have been times where I like, they wake me up and then I hear like one fish crow and I like make a mental note of it and that I'll report that later or whatever. And I'm sure I've fallen back asleep and probably had dreams with crows or other birds then too. But yeah, I just don't. Do you ever remember them?
I remember places that I okay. am. Where I've birded in local patches or places in my state, like on the Outer Banks or stuff in dreams, or in Columbia or places like that. Like I think that if I sat down and started, you know, if I kept track of it as soon as I woke up, I could probably remember the birds that were in there. But I've never done that. Maybe I will. Y'all have inspired me. I did have a situation like that, Frank, just past week where I was woken up by a pair of barred owls that were yelling really loudly.
Oh, nice.
In my neighborhood. And I kind of went back to sleep. I was half awake when you wake up and you kind of are there, but I distinctly heard them. Yeah, I don't know. But I'm going to start keeping a dream list, y'all. You've inspired me. And I feel like I've gotten the right two people on this show for this.
It'll give you so much. Yeah, you'll get so much joy looking back at some of these.
Yeah.
Brains are so weird. And the key is you have to write it as soon as you wake up, because you got to remember the juicy details.
That's true.
But once it happens, it just happens. Again, I just got told and then that night it happened. So maybe.
So when you have them written down, can you see those dreams vividly in your head when you remember them, or as the memory gone and it's only just the bird on the
aren't there
screenshot?
There's light bulb memories or something. There's phrase for like where you tell yourself enough that you remember, but you don't actually. And I don't know if that's because like I have some pretty like descriptive things for my first few dreams. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I've just read them enough that I'm like, oh yeah, I remember, but I don't. Mm-hmm. I think I remember.
Right.
But does that make sense?
Yeah. For me, it varies. Some of them, I read the description and I just kind of conjure up what it must have been like. And some of them, like, you know, I distinctly remember the dream where the pileated woodpecker came to my bird feeder because I was, oh my God, in Brooklyn? That's way.
I like that you respond in your dream exactly like you would in real life.
I mean, so when something, you know.
Well, this is a good question to throw to listeners, I think. If anyone out there has had any very vivid bird dreams, please send them to podcast@aviate.org and I will share them with Ryan and Jordan and Frank too, if he wants to sing too, even though he hasn't had any bird dreams per se.
We're always birding.
We're always birding, even unconsciously. Thank you to all three of you for joining me. This was a really fun conversation. Jordan Rutter, Ryan Mandelbaum, Frank Izagiri. There are links to all the things we talked about in the show notes. Please check those out. Have a great spring to all three of you. We'll see you down the road.
Thanks, all. Happy birding.
Happy birding.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
The American Birding Podcast is brought to you by the American Birding Association. Don't forget to join the ABA. If you enjoyed this podcast, you'll be eligible for a lot of great benefits, including our fantastic magazines, all our online stuff like the magazine archive, the identification portal, and of course, discounts to partners like OM System, Beauty of Books, Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and more. You can learn more about becoming a member at aba.org/join. Special shout out this week to Asher Fusco of Brooklyn, New York, who joined the ABA recently and noted this podcast as a reason for doing so. Thank you so much, Asher. Welcome to the ABA. Executive director of the ABA and executive producer of this podcast is Wayne Klockner, who remembers Pauly Shore's turn as a teenager who finds a frozen troglodyte making a nest in his cable box in the cult classic Rencino Man. Technical production is by John Lowry, who loved Pauly in his 1994 war comedy about small brown warblers foraging in dried leaves in The Wormy Now. Additional help comes from Maggie Fitzgibbon and Greg Neese, who recall with fondness Pauly Shore's fish-out-of-water turn as the original weasel who spent Thanksgiving with his girlfriend's family at a litigious shorebird banding station in Dunlinlaw. I'm not sure how well that one works. You can find us online at aba.org, on social media most everywhere as American Birding Association. On Blue Sky, we are at ABA Birds. Questions, comments can come to podcast@aba.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Nate Swick. Bird like Tom. We'll see you next week.